All right, that will conclude the State versus Reese case, and then we'll now take up the State versus Kevin Dickerson file. And Christopher Miles appears on behalf of the defendant and petitioner, Mr. Dickerson, and Ms. Hanke appears for the Attorney General's office. As I indicated, each side has 15 minutes initially, and then, Mr. Miles, you'll have 5 minutes rebuttal. You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. Credibility, bias, motive to lie, these subjects are relevant when any witness takes the stand. And they're especially relevant when the case turns on credibility determinations. Both the state and the defense in this case acknowledged this was a credibility contest. Dickerson's trial attorney told the circuit court, credibility will be a central issue in this case. And the prosecutor told the jury, really it comes down to one question, who do you believe? Rojas doesn't have anything at stake in this case. But Rojas had 4 years of lawful residency in the United States at stake. Rojas had the potential for lawful permanent residency here in the United States at stake. And we can't overlook how coveted these benefits would be to somebody who is here in the United States residing illegally. These benefits, they were contingent on helping and assisting the prosecution. And Mr. Rojas did lie. He did embellish testimony. He lied to the jury. He lied to the police officer that responded to the scene. He lied to the detective that investigated the case. He withheld information from law enforcement. He deleted text messages. And he did this to protect himself. The circuit court's ruling prevented Dickerson from providing the jury with relevant evidence.
Excuse me, you just mentioned he deleted text messages. I don't recall that being part of the record. There was an absence of them, but I don't recall anyone referring to him deleting them.
I do not have the exact citation, but I know that Mr. Rojas specifically stated that he deletes text messages. And the reason I remember, there was something to do with insurance. He had some sort of an insurance concern, and he did testify that he deleted his text messages. That's why he didn't have them to produce when the detective asked him about text messages. Now, the circuit court's ruling, it did deny Dickerson effective cross-examination. It denied him the ability to present a complete defense, and it usurped the role of the jury in making this credibility determination. This error affected the jury's verdict, as did the admission of State's Exhibit 1. There were four exhibits in this case that were admitted through the business records exception to the rule against hearsay. Three of those came from the defense, Defense Exhibit A, B, and C. Those were Verizon cell phone records. And we know that those were Verizon cell phone records because Dickerson's trial attorney presented to the circuit court a certificate of authenticity, which was signed off on by a Verizon employee. That satisfied 8036's requirements for foundational purposes. State's Exhibit 1, this was purported to be a MetaBank record. The court heard no testimony from an employee from MetaBank. The circuit court received no certificate of authenticity. And the transactions that occurred on the bank card are a big piece of evidence in this case. And that's a line taken from the state's attorney's closing argument. State v. Stokes tells us Exhibit 1 should not have been admitted. The state's big piece of evidence should not have been admitted. Now, going back to the immigration status exclusion, there's really two components to this, the evidentiary admissibility issue and then the constitutional issues that are also presented. The admissibility of this would be reviewed for an abuse of discretion. It's our position that this evidence is relevant. It's probative of his motive to fabricate, Rojas' motive to exaggerate the allegations, and that he has a personal interest in the outcome of this case. The partiality of a witness, that's something that's always relevant. being able to discredit the witness, that goes to the weight of the witness's testimony. And as the circuit court ruled, this was very limited in its relevancy. So the circuit court did acknowledge this is relevant evidence, and it moved on to the balancing test. In doing so, the circuit court did misapply the balancing test in that it found that the evidence was more prejudicial than probative. But the test is whether the probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. The circuit court cited certain public policy concerns. The possibility that testimony related to immigration status would deter those individuals from reporting crimes, called this character evidence, and indicated that because Rojas said that he had received no promise in exchange for his testimony, it was not relevant. And finally, that this could possibly turn into a mini-trial about immigration status. First of all, Dickerson's constitutional claims should prevail against those concerns. With regard to those concerns, I would like to speak about some of them specifically. The mini-trial. I don't think that fear was really present in this case because Rojas admitted in that pretrial hearing that he was here illegally. There was really no further litigation that would have needed to take place with regard to that issue. I understand that that was something that had been cited in other cases. It was not present here.
Would there be some ancillary questions, not necessarily about the lawfulness of his presence in the country, but the U visa program, how it works, and would the judge be justified in thinking, you know, we're not going to send this case careening off course into the finer points of immigration law? Would that be a concern? Was that the concern here? What are your thoughts?
I would recognize that could possibly be a concern, and that's where the reasonable limitations on cross-examination would come into play. And so I think that that is something that the circuit court could examine as it's happening, recognizing that this evidence is relevant, it is probative, also possibly having the concern that, well, we don't want to go too far in this direction regarding the U visa. It could be reeled back in that sense. Now, Dickerson has stated a violation of the Confrontation Clause. This is a violation because the circuit court's ruling prohibited Dickerson from establishing facts from which jurors could appropriately draw inferences related to the reliability of this witness. So this was a complete exclusion of the relevant evidence. Dickerson didn't get to ask one single question about this motive to lie, this bias. It was not a general attack on Mr. Rojas' character. It was not the inference that his overall character for trustworthiness should not be trusted because he is here illegally. The opportunity for full and fair cross-examination did not occur in this case. It was not fulfilled. Now, the prosecutor also asked in closing, why would Rojas want to do this? The cross-examination in this case could have provided that possible answer. Now, did Rojas have a motive to testify in a certain manner? That's one question. But if he did the motive actually influence his testimony? Is he simply seeking justice, or does he have a potential benefit? These are questions that should have been asked by the jury in deliberations. And because this ruling adversely affected Dickerson, it limited his ability to present a complete defense. And as Mr. Cady noted, a theory supported by law, even with a tenuous foundation in the evidence, that defendant has the right to present that defense.
Would that apply in all cases? Wherever there's a U visa issue or potential issue, the cases is the parties have cited them in your brief and the other briefs, Mr. Miles. Sometimes it's timing, it's whether they knew it at a particular time, it's whether there was this was said or that was said. And I was having a hard time pulling together a list of really helpful factors that would help circuit courts or trial courts exercise their discretion in a way that navigated around the constitutional commands that are implicated here. Do you have any thoughts on any of that?
I do. Justice, when you asked the previous parties about when maybe this would not be appropriate, I think we do have an answer, and it actually comes from a case that was cited in the state's brief. I believe that was Chavez-Limon. That was a case in which the complaining witness filed for the application for U visa 2 years after reporting the initial incident. But what occurred was the state's attorney actually rejected that complaining witness's request for assistance. In that case, there's clearly no longer a benefit that's expected. I suppose the U visa, they could also seek a different law enforcement agency to go ahead and try to get them to assist. But I think that's a clear case of the motive to lie has really extinguished itself because the prosecutor said, I'm not going to be helping you with this U visa. So that is one instance. Of course, there could be others.
The state in the preceding argument characterized the evidence as overwhelming. Do you agree with that?
We do not agree with that. I think that in this case, a case that I cited in my brief, Romero Perez, that was a case. They did look at a very similar issue. Essentially, they ruled that was harmless error because in a case like that, that was an alleged burglary and assault. There were footsteps that came up to the window in which the complaining witness said, this is where the assailant entered. The assailant said that he came in through the front door. But importantly, there were two other witnesses that were inside of the apartment that actually witnessed the attack. And there was blood in the closet where the individual that the complaining witness said that she was attacked. Here we have only one person, Julio Rojas Gomez. He was the only person that testified in the state's case that was inside of the apartment at that time. This is not overwhelming evidence. We see the jury's verdict. They did acquit on some counts. I think that this was a close case. And I think that categorizing this as overwhelming evidence is a way to try to avoid or sidestep the underlying issues. When we speak about overwhelming evidence, I would like to turn then to the second issue that I raised in the brief with regard to those bank records. The state is acknowledging that those weren't entered with proper foundation under the 8036 requirements. And so I think I would just go ahead and start in on how this actually affected Mr. Dickerson's substantial rights, how this did affect the jury's verdict and contribute to the conviction. We know that it did because we know that the prosecutor thought that this evidence would affect the verdict. The prosecutor told the jury, these records are a big piece of evidence. The number of transactions shown on the bank card is consistent with identity theft. The state's argument is these bank records show this was a robbery, not a sexual assault attempt, showed the intent to commit a robbery. The prosecutor emphasized the importance of these transactions because they knew that it would affect the verdict. And I think that we all recognize that Mr. Rojas, neither the detective, can qualify as a custodian of records or a qualifying witness. Furthermore, I think that whether or not this was actually authenticated through Mr. Rojas' testimony is questionable. This bank record, it was basically an Excel spreadsheet that listed off some transactions. It did not have the MetaBank logo, letterhead, any sort of sign or signal that would say this actually did come from MetaBank. And it did not even have Mr. Rojas Gomez's name on it. So I think that certainly this evidence should not have been admitted. The state recognized that there was a way in which evidence like this can be admitted without having to bring in a witness from MetaBank to establish that foundation. That's the certificate of authenticity. And that essentially is self-authenticating. So that is the route that they could have taken to get what they considered to be a big piece of evidence in front of the jury. And as we know, Mr. Rojas, when he was testifying, and we recognized that the prosecutor used the number of transactions, Mr. Rojas had this purported bank record in his hands while he was testifying and went through one through, I believe it was 19, transactions that occurred. These errors did affect the jury's verdict. And with regard to the constitutional claims, as Mr. Cady mentioned, this does need to be reviewed under the Chapman standard for harmless error. It needs to be found that the U visa issue and the confrontation and right to present a defense issue was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miles. Ms. Hanke, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. Obviously, Kevin Dickerson is the co-defendant to Ariana Reese, which we heard arguments on moments ago. The state does rely on arguments made just moments previously. I won't rehash all of those, but if the court has questions, I certainly welcome those. In addition, there are a few points made by Dickerson's attorney that I would like to address.
Ms. Tangi, maybe just to go with the most recent argument he made, without the bank records at all, what evidence besides Mr. Rojas' testimony supported the robbery charge and the element of burglary that there was an intent to steal?
Sure. So in regards to the burglary, just kind of going chronological in the order of events, if you will, there's surveillance evidence of Dickerson. So Gomez Rojas lives in the apartment building. It's a locked building, so he had to go down to let Reese into that building. And when he did, there's surveillance evidence of Reese motioning for Gomez Rojas to go up the steps first, and then you can see her push the door open really wide, and as she's going up the steps, Dickerson catches that door and kind of creeps in. Then there is, so he's, you know, he had to be let in. There's also evidence of him coming into the apartment for a second time. Those both show intent. In terms of the robbery, there is a wound on Gomez Rojas's forehead that is consistent with being hit in the head with a gun, as Gomez Rojas testified to. So that goes to the robbery as well. And then, like I said, there was evidence in addition to Gomez Rojas's testimony to corroborate what he said. So, for instance, the screaming that the neighbors heard of him being all bloodied and bruised from being hit with a gun as opposed to a cell phone.
But, you know, those would certainly go toward the assault. How do you think they're then connected to the elements for the other elements for the robbery and the burglary?
Well, in terms of burglary, it's enters or remains in an occupied structure with the intent to commit a crime. The assault also could have been in line with that. I mean, you come bursting into the door and point a gun at someone's head. Aggravated assault. In terms of the robbery, we have Gomez Rojas's, well, you want besides his testimony, the absence of his wallet at his residence is certainly.
Well, didn't Ms. Reese admit in her testimony that she had his card, his bank card?
Yes, in her testimony, I believe she testified that Gomez Rojas gave her his bank card. So then that would come down to, again, it would come down to who is telling the truth and what evidence supports each witness, so to speak.
So, and what you just said is kind of the other question that I had is to how, so if we were to conclude, well, that the state has essentially conceded that there wasn't foundation for the bank records. So if you take the bank records out of the equation, how does that also then play in if we were to conclude that there was an error in precluding the cross-examination as to his immigration status and the U visa inquiries?
In
so
terms
if,
of like,
if we take that out of the equation and then we're looking at the harmless error analysis, then we're left with the stories of the two and the surveillance videos, essentially. Correct?
There's also, like I said, the photographic evidence as well as the neighbor's testimony. Not only did they hear Gomez Rojas screaming, but they saw Dickerson and Reese fleeing the apartment.
But then we also have the photographs of the of Reese's injuries as well, correct?
Yes, that is correct. She has photographs of bruises. However, when she the night she was arrested, she told law enforcement those bruises were caused from dancing at the club.
You didn't mention this in your other argument, but I'm assuming you don't dispute, but if you do, please tell us, Mr. And this was Mr. Cady's argument about the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt that has to be shown given the constitutional issues being argued here.
No, I do not dispute that, Your Honor.
And with the two different versions that we have here and some of the physical evidence at least arguably supporting either one, how do we reach that conclusion that this was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Because they were both defendants were still provided opportunity to cross-examine Gomez Rojas, and they were able to call into question, you know, you reported to law enforcement this, but now it's a little bit different here on the stand. For instance, he was asked, how come you didn't tell law enforcement that you had been texting with Reese that day? There was a discrepancy in he didn't report initially to law enforcement that he was grabbed by his neck. And so these things, they were able to inquire into how come, you know, there's a little bit of discrepancy. That attacks his credibility right there. In addition, Reese testified to the alleged attempted rape that occurred. And so Reese and Dickerson both were able to put on the defense that really Gomez Rojas attempted to rape Reese. So they were able to present a defense, and they were able to cross-examine Gomez Rojas.
Just not as much as they wanted to.
Correct. And it's been long held that cross-examination is not a free-for-all. You don't get to just ask a witness anything you want. There can and will be limitations to that.
Mr. Cady's argument, I think, was that, you know, in a closed case where it turns on the credibility of the witnesses, more is better than less. So how confident can we be that what you just said in terms of the extent to which the defense was able to present its theory and do some type of impeachment is enough to satisfy the constitutional commands that are implicated here?
I mean, I think the potential of being arrested and tried, convicted of a rape allegation is a huge motive to lie. And that was the opportunity to cross-examine. And in terms of immigration status, I know there's been talk today, and forgive me if Mr. Cady mentioned it, not Chris Miles. I do not mean any disrespect to go outside this argument, but in terms of, you know, possible deportation, that's all very speculative. There's been no evidence, as far as I'm aware of, that Gomez Rojas was being investigated by immigration. He was facing deportation, and this was the only way to save himself. There's been no evidence to that kind. So it's purely speculative as to that motive.
Okay.
Counsel, were there competing public policy concerns that the trial court considered in making the 403 balancing determination? on this issue of immigration status and the visa.
If I'm understanding your question correctly, Your Honor, are you asking if the immigration status and the visa were two separate public policy issues?
Yes.
I think they are. I think immigration is one issue and the visa is another. I believe the court did balance both of those issues in arriving at her determination.
Does that have a role in the 403 determination? Excluding the evidence seems like, you know, based upon policy concerns, seems like more of an indirect way to further the policy. Unlike, for instance, let's say 412, the rape shield rule of evidence, where Congress, not the drafters of the rules, has said it doesn't come in, with an exception for the Constitution. But here, this U visa program doesn't have that command. It doesn't say, hey, this is off limits. You can't introduce it. And at best, it seems like excluding the evidence would maybe indirectly serve the policy. Is that a valid 403 consideration?
I think in determining, in doing the 403 analysis, I think you can look at public policy. I don't think it's the final determinant, if you will, Your Honor. I think there are other factors that play into that. But I do believe that the trial court in this case did not make a blatant public policy decision. The trial court looked at this case, the specific case, and what Gomez Rojas testified to in the hearing outside of the jury and determined that it was the evidence was prejudice and would not come in. And then, Justice Salter, I believe you had asked Mr. Miles about the U visa and if timing is important. And I think it is a factor to look at. You know, you asked about factors in deriving a test, if you will, or factors to look at in making these kinds of determinations. And I do think timing is important. I think it's important to look at what did the victim know at the time of the attack. And he testified he did not know about this U visa until approximately a week after he was not only attacked, but reported to law enforcement. And so I think that is an important factor to look out here, because at the time he reported this incident to law enforcement, he did not know about the U visa.
What if the victim or witness lies about that?
I mean, they certainly can, Your Honor, but there has been no evidence presented that he was lying about that.
But then the court's kind of in that difficult position of being a weighing the evidence preliminarily about that. Maybe they can under the rules. I'm just curious.
I think specifically in this case, there has been no evidence that Gomez Rojas knew about the U visa at the time he reported. In addition, after he found out, he did not apply for the U visa. There's been no indication that he applied. In fact, he told the trial court he didn't even know if he was going to apply for this visa. So again, it's kind of this, well, maybe I will, maybe I won't. So how is that relevant here don't even know if he's going to apply for it?
Seems like a difficult way to apply a test, though, because it would be pretty easy to, if that were the determining factor, it would be pretty easy to skirt that by just holding off every request for a visa until the trial was done. Would that?
I mean, that is a fair point, Your Honor, and I'm not saying timing's the only factor to look at, but I do think it is an important factor to look at. I don't think it's the determinative factor, if you will. I don't think we can just say, oh, we didn't. I understand your concerns, Your Honor. I'll say that. If there are no further questions, the state would ask this court to affirm defendant's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hankey. Mr. Miles, you have a 5-minute rebuttal.
Thank you. I suppose I would just like to start with, I'm not sure that I fully really fleshed out the idea behind presenting a complete defense, and what I think is the more troubling problem here is that Dickerson didn't have the ability to respond or rebut the state's argument. And I think that's what, in my opinion, strikes at the heart of the fundamental fairness of the underlying trial. And so because of that, Dickerson was left with an incomplete defense. He was unable to present evidence that responded specifically to the state's assertion that Mr. Rojas had nothing at stake here in this case. And because of that, the jury didn't get a full picture of Mr. Rojas, that he did have a motive to protect himself, that he had a personal interest in the outcome. Now, the state also discusses the evidence here that I think we have to keep in mind. Reese did testify that she brought Kevin with her that day or that night because she wanted protection. And so what does the surveillance video show? It shows that they went inside of the apartment. It also shows that when Mr. Rojas was speaking with Officer O'Brien and mentioned that Ms. Reese had just entered his apartment, he had no expectation that she was going to be arriving. That was completely untrue. And so there is definitely questions that are remaining here. In this case, it is much closer than the state is letting on. Now, Justice Salter has brought up some points with regard to, I suppose, just a person being here illegally. Certainly being here illegally, you're standing on shaky ground. But if you are here illegally and you have a pending attempted rape allegation that's also carrying along with that, that's an earthquake below your feet. That's a very different issue. It certainly causes the level of tension within that individual to rise with regard to their status here in this country. And I think with regard to the timing, again, Justice Salter brought up maybe this witness is lying. And I think that should be something that is spoken about back in jury deliberations. One juror could ask another, well, he said that he spoke with this immigration attorney 1 week after. Well, do you think that that's actually the case? That is something that the jury should be determining. And those specifics with regard to timing, application, all of those more finer details, I believe should be addressed by the jury. Finally, I think some of the public policy concerns, I know, of course, I believe that those will always yield to Dickerson's constitutional rights. But when I look at the U visa, and maybe it could be parsed out with regard to questions concerning the U visa and questions concerning immigration status, but specifically with the U visa, I think there's only an incentive to report a crime. Take, for example, an individual who is here in this country experiencing domestic violence. That person has the option. I can report this crime and potentially have my status adjusted by applying for a U visa. What's on the other side of that? Not reporting the crime. You don't eliminate the potential for abuse. You would continue possibly to be abused. And there's no way that your status would be adjusted based on that.
Yeah, I don't know if it matters in this case, but I've thought about that too. I don't know if that, I'm still thinking about it, but couldn't you make an argument that by exposing himself or herself to the scrutiny of law enforcement, that their immigration status, although previously not disclosed, would now become a part of their complaint? And maybe there's a certain amount of risk. Either they get this visa or they don't. And if they don't, they're out there now.
I recognize that, and I think there's a balancing. They would continue to remain undocumented here in the country illegally, and that's all. That risk will remain no matter what. Now, do they want to risk just becoming on to law enforcement's radar? Is that something that they would be concerned about? Possibly, but in light of the U visa, there's certainly a benefit, and I think that would be a balancing of interest. And it should, again, these questions should remain within the province of the jury. We would ask that you reverse and remand this court for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miles. The case is now submitted. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.